be entirely drained in under an hour, and need weeks to recharge to its full potential. Okay, I had to admit that made it less overwhelming. But to store that much mana, it can't be as simple as drawing the diagram, right? After all, even an iron sword could only hold a few hundred mana before shattering. You're right. That's where things get tricky. At the center of every ward, you need to place a control device that connects to the trigger. This device also has to have an object placed in it that stores the mana for the entire ward. The only thing I've found so far that can store that kind of energy without breaking is a pure crystal. It was at that point that her shoulders began to slump down. I managed to get one as a reward from the Queen for gifting them various items, but that's just enough for one ward. I won't be able to do anything for all the other towns. I couldn't help but reach a hand out, patting her shoulder gently as I smiled to her. Let's start here. If the ward works, maybe the Queen will consider reinforcing the other cities that are in danger as well. Her head nodded faintly as she heard that, before her hands came up and lightly slapped her cheeks. Okay, you're right. Anyways, we need to make sure that this works first. So there are two more things that I need to explain to you about wards, the area they cover and the trigger mechanism. Saying that, she took a deep breath before continuing. For the area, it's fairly easy. It is defined by where you place the wards. To create a warded area, you need a minimum of 3 separate ward markers. The more markers you have, the larger the area and more detailed you can make it. To create a perimeter around the entire city, I imagine we'll need at least 50. Each ward marker is simply an item upon which the pattern for the ward is drawn. It can be facing in any direction, but must be within a certain range of its neighbor markers. We can use the city's walls for this. Finally, the triggering mechanism. After the area of the ward is laid out, you have to define its control point with one final marker placed inside the area. This marker will be different. To demonstrate, she ran up to her room, grabbed another scroll, and came down. It seemed to depict a different diagram on it than before, though there were many similarities. In the triggering mechanism, the trigger diagram takes the primary position, while the main function is outlined on the side. She pointed out the 2 big changes before rolling the scroll up. We just need to have the crystal embedded within the mechanism, and we can activate it at will. Now that she had apparently finished explaining everything, she let out a long sigh of relief before lifting her head back up. Now, any questions? Yes, just one. You said that it would take a few days to finish explaining everything to me. That was less than an hour. I glanced outside, seeing that the sun hadn't even set yet. Oh, that. I was hoping to spend the rest of the time humping like Linux in heat, she admitted quite readily, causing my mouth to gape open just slightly. What? You can't say it wouldn't be fun. Besides, I really want to know if there would be anything special about a child born from the descended bodies of a keeper and a goddess. You have to admit, you are at least a little curious, right? I don't know which to retort about. That you want to keep me here for sex, or that you want a baby purely for research purposes. Rion, you are the goddess of magic and wealth, not wisdom. Stop taking Akalia's job. Technically, you just retorted about both of them. Besides, we still need to have you practice the diagram a few times to make sure you can get it right while everyone is watching. Knowing you, that should only take a couple days, but then we have to actually carve it into the stone walls 30 times. Unless you feel like training the druid class for a while first, so you can do it more easily. The city stopped devoting resources to me when I tried to assert my theories. Thal Highborn couldn't help but smile wryly as he watched the traveler Jael being dragged away by the mad enchanter Rinan. His partner, Curahan, walked up to him, dark circles under his eyes, from the 3-day duty. "He's a friend of hers, huh?" he asked, skeptically, glancing in the direction that the two had left in. "Seems that way," Thal nodded. "I just hope that she doesn't do anything too crazy this time." He didn't want another repeat of the City of Lights incident, where one of her wards managed to accidentally make the entire city and everyone inside of it glow brightly for over an hour. Leave them to what they want to do. We've got some time off now. Curahan said with a faint smile, followed by a yawn. I could sleep for a week. Although standing watch alone on the wall for 3 days was a dangerous job, it was not without its rewards. specifically a 7-day period after the shift in which they can relax, unless an emergency occurs. Right. Say thanks to Levi for me, Thal said, remembering his partner's wife waiting for him at home. She was the one who had sent them their rations for the days that they were stuck on the wall, so he wanted to make sure she knew he appreciated it. Will do. Try to keep out of trouble, Thal's partner said, waving to him wearily as he began moving back towards his home. As for Thal himself, he grabbed a nearby broom and began helping the residents sweep up the mess left by the turtle tide. It took nearly a week before he saw the Wanderer jail again, having nearly forgotten about him. When he did see him again, he had a tired expression on his face, as if he had gone through several sleepless nights in order to prepare himself. Meanwhile, the mad Renan stood next to him with a beaming smile, practically glowing as the two walked towards the outer walls. This was her 6th attempt at creating a protective ward for the city, and the residents had long since grown tired of her antics. While they wouldn't actively stop her, they would also not give her any help, and she would be strictly punished for any mishaps that occurred. She was still working off her debt from her last ward. Yet this time it was not Renan who was carving the wards into the walls, but Jael. Despite his apparent tired state, he took his time carving one ward after another, evenly spaced along the walls. When each one was done, he would take a few steps back and look at it, before nodding to himself and moving on to the next. The entire process took him 2 days, even when he had made himself work through the night. Thal had to admit that his dedication and perseverance were worthy of praise, but also lowered his impression of Renan another level. After all, if not for her standing behind him, watching the entire time with that smile, would Jael have really put himself through that? It was late into the 2nd day when he finished the last ward, and anyone could tell that he was barely able to keep himself on his feet by that point. Several of the residents had offered him food and drink as they saw him stumbling down the road, yet he ignored them all. Nobody seemed to mind, not because they felt he was doing it on purpose, but most simply thought he was too tired to even notice the people around him. The last that Thal saw of Jael was when he returned to Renan's house. No doubt he had left the city early the next day, after he had some proper sleep. It must have simply been before Thal returned to duty. Though even though it was widely accepted that he left early in the day, nobody could actually remember seeing him leave. Thal had invited himself over to Renan's home in order to check her ward, and confirmed that he had left. So he decided to believe the rumor that had been accepted. Nobody would really know what became of Jael, the researcher who would soon be known to the entire kingdom. Chapter 19. After returning to the admin room, I collapsed in bed and slept for, I don't even know how long. Although I could technically go without sleep, and my mind was adjusting to that, that only applied to the admin room. When it comes to being immortal, my body still definitely needed rest, which was something I had learned the hard way. After waking up, I dragged myself over to the computer and saw a blinking message, showing that someone had tried to send me a conversation request. Likely, it was while I was unavailable. Shaking my head, I opened the message to see what they wanted. There was really only one person that would message me out of the blue like that. Alkahest. Hey, Dale, just wanted to send you a tip to let you know that there won't be a meeting this month. It's the official annual meeting, and Earth hasn't been listed in the games yet. I had almost forgotten about the Keeper meetings, but either way, this didn't bother me. This gave me plenty of time to figure out what I was doing on my own world before worrying about somebody else's. Speaking of my world, Terra? I thought inwardly, too tired to try to figure out where I had left the communication paper. Hopefully my mind was too worn out to send the loud messages that they had been worried about before. Dale, a reply came shortly after, though not from Terra. Behenna's questioning tone told me everything I needed to know. Wrong number, but I'll send her your way. Thanks. It was probably easier to talk in person than over the thought chat radio, or whatever we were calling it now. So I turned to face the door, slouched over and propping myself up by my elbows, until Terra came into the room. "Hey, Dale, see you finally decided to wake up," she said with a toothy grin, her tail wrapped around her waist like a belt. Currently, she seemed to be wearing a dress woven out of golden silk. "So, what's up?" "Not going to ask how long I was out," I began, not even wanting to know. "But I've got a question, and it is semi-urgent. What would a child be like if their parents were a descended keeper and a god's avatar?" Tara had a knowing smile on her face as she listened to that. "You mean you and Rion? She wouldn't stop talking about it while you were asleep, and normally there might not be that much difference. Maybe a slight increase in talent. However, things are a bit different for you, since you have the God-King achievement." "Oh, you don't mean..." I turned my head to look at the computer and opened up the notifications. "Congratulations. You have earned a new achievement. For bestowing the bloodline of the gods upon the mortal world, you have received the Demigod's Descent achievement, plus 20 points. "I created a demigod?" I asked, placing my face into my palm. "Okay, what's going to happen now with it?" "Well, Trival's demigods didn't really do anything special. He was mating with the variant centaurs enough to almost single-handedly run their entire species. However, really, things are a bit random. Most likely they will be born with the protagonist aura, and will be successful at whatever they seek to accomplish in life. There is a very rare chance that the divinity in their blood grants them an extra power, but so far that hasn't happened yet in your world," she explained patiently. It was only at this moment that I realized that Trival had indeed made plenty of holy babies, and yet I had never received this achievement before. So I had to do it myself, huh? "Well, what about normal children between your incarnations and mortals?" "Behenna's son didn't show any special talents, so I would say that the connection is weak enough for it not to affect the child," she said with a shrug, walking over to sit down at the bed. "However, as the God-King, you are a different story. In order to not create a demigod, you would need to completely cut yourself off from your keeper powers while you were in the act. And lately you've been keeping your keeper health and stamina active. Not at all a bad decision, and it'll probably save your life later, but it also means you make god babies." She sounded just a bit too amused with that last part. I couldn't help but lift my head up to look at her curiously. "You seem oddly okay with this. I thought you would be a bit more upset that I made Rion pregnant. After all, she had been fairly hesitant towards my initial goal of a heavenly harem. Not that I really see them like that anymore." "I've said it before, Rion's fine. Most of the girls up here are. If I had to list two girls as off-limits, Aurevi and Yudana." She nodded her head confidently. "Aurevi, because the whole sister dynamic, and Yudana because of her memories. Like you've learned yourself, the memories and personalities of the gods and goddesses you create aren't always how you would imagine. It'd create a giant mess if you just went around sleeping with them before even confirming what kind of person they were, right?" I still can't help but think that there is something else going on with this. "You already gave Rion a punishment, didn't you?" "First of all, you forgot to turn off the mental communication," she said with a bitter smile. "And I may have paid her a visit, but I didn't do anything drastic. Called it. Okay. Well, you can tell Aurevi that I'll head down to visit you two next. Though not to make more demigods. I just need a bit of time to check up on the world and get over my previous descent. It had lasted quite a bit longer than I had originally planned." Tara nodded her head with a grin, not even waiting before she turned around and headed out the door, no doubt seeking out Aurevi to let her know what I just said. Shaking my head with a sigh, I turned myself back around to face the computer, checking to see if anything interesting was happening in the mortal world. Deep within the village of the Hidden Fog, one particular beastkin was attempting a new technique he had been working on. Before him sat several bars of precious copper. This was a metal that the village had found hidden deposits of this material within the forest. After a few years of study, it was found possibly to melt a certain part of the metal from the ore and separate it through the use of various techniques. After that, naturally, people had begun reshaping the metal into more deadly shapes, such as arrowheads or daggers. However, Phila had another idea. An idea to create a weapon more deadly than a dagger, more accurate than an arrow, and perfectly suited to their abilities. His hands quickly came together, forming various shapes as he channeled his chakra into them. Each sign seemed to resonate with his chakra, until he held the final sign as a circle with his thumbs and index fingers connecting. His other fingers all spread out. Under his breath, he recited the name of the technique in order to help him focus his chakra further, metal melting. As his chakra poured into the copper bars in front of him, they gradually turned red, showing signs of melting. In order to prevent an accident, he willed his chakra to lift the metal into the air before him, watching as it gradually formed into a single glob of amorphous copper. Clapping his hands together, the blob trembled as it was compressed slightly. Lifting his hands, he once again made a circle with his fingers, before pulling his hands apart. In response, the copper formed into the shape of a small circle and began expanding, leaving a wide hole in the middle. Already he could see the effects from his previous technique wearing off, the metal starting to cool and harden again. However, he wasn't done yet. He clapped his hands together again, this time with both palms facing him, one hand slapping the other. Again the metal compressed, and again he clapped. With every clap, it was as if the metal was being struck by a hammer, suspended in mid-air and gradually cooling. One clap after another seemed to strike at the circle of metal, until the outer edge resembled a thin blade. Satisfied with this result, he lifted his hands back up, forming another circle facing the metal, and moved his hands over to the side, lowering them down. The circle of metal followed the movement, lowering itself into a pot of fresh red blood. This was the blood of the Shadow Wolf, a beast the village had discovered over a century ago to be capable of using chakra. And it was also the key ingredient in this forging, used to temper the weapon that Fila wanted to make. He watched the steam rising from the pot of blood, bubbles rising up as it began to boil. When he lifted his hands back up, he caused the circle of metal to fly into the air and land on the table, right where the original bars had been located. By now, his ki and mana were almost exhausted, leaving him unable to continue to the final step. Thankfully, he had been expecting that, and grabbed two glass potion bottles from nearby, one blue and the other green. One after the other, he chugged them down without hesitation, allowing his energy to refill slightly. The village's alchemists had not found a way to completely restore someone's mana and ki, but their potions would restore a significant portion. Taking a moment to let the potions take effect, he once again began the hand signs. At first, they seemed to be identical to the ones he had performed before, except for the very last one. This time, his final hand sign was a one-handed circle with his thumb and index finger, his other fingers extended together. Metal engraving. After saying that, he lowered his fingers down towards the cooling metal, keeping them several inches from its surface. Once a few seconds had passed, a red dot formed in the metal, which followed the movements of his fingers as he began to etch in complicated symbols, those which they had found most useful in storing ki. At a glance, they looked like the components in spell diagrams, except that their shapes were less rigid, more natural. When Fila had completely engraved both sides with those symbols, he let out a deep breath, sending the disc of metal to cool in the blood once again. Afterwards, he carefully wiped it down with a cloth, smiling at his creation. A completely circular blade, made to be wielded either by hand or thrown. But more importantly, if Fila's theory was right, it should easily be able to hold chakra, allowing it to be controlled remotely. After pouring a bit of chakra into the blade, he caused it to rise into the air with more ease than he had its previous raw form. With a thought, it began spinning rapidly, the sound of it cutting the air almost audible. Fila glanced down to his stone table and flicked his finger, causing the weapon to fly down at it, piercing halfway into the stone before stopping. With a satisfied nod, he spoke as if talking to his new creation. "I will call you Chakram, the weapon made for chakra." He knew that once he shared this weapon and its forging process with the rest of the village, it would usher in a new age for them. Although they would need to learn how to properly wield this weapon, it should drastically increase the fighting potential of any single ninja. Still, Fila had no idea how happy his actions were making a certain pair of ninja-loving goddesses, who had chosen to watch over his actions with high hopes in their heart. They had not influenced him in any way, and yet he had created a weapon that they had been looking forward to for quite a while. Chapter 20. Huh, I never figured refining could be done like that, I thought to myself, as I watched the scene of the feline man creating a chakram. Though I inevitably facepalmed when I realized the relationship between the name and its purpose, at least I'm not the only one with a bad naming sense around here. From what I could see, the legacy class system was starting to be put to good use. As evidence of that, the feline ninja that had invented the chakram actually possessed a class known as Ninja Craftsman. When I looked at the class details, I actually discovered something rather interesting. It seemed that the system had added an unintentional, hidden feature in the legacy classes, or maybe it was just how it was worded, but as the keeper I was able to see the list of skills recorded for the class. For this particular class, the skills were Metal Melting Seal, Metal Engraving Seal, Talisman Script, and Talisman Bind. Three of these skills I had just witnessed the man using personally, assuming that the talisman script explained the symbols he engraved on the chakram. As for the last one, I focused on the binding skill, and a short written description appeared, likely written by the progenitor of the class. This skill enables one to bind a half-completed chakra technique into a talisman, to be activated when given the proper signal. Okay, the legacy class system ended up being way more useful for me than I expected. If I'm reading this right, I will have access to the written logs of any legacy class I identify. I'll still need to train the skills myself, but this changes things from blind study to giving me a brief guide. And having that little bit of a guide could bring quite a lot of help in the future. I made a mental note to start looking for interesting legacy classes later on, once the system became more widespread. For now, it seemed to still be a fairly rarely used system. Once more people discover it and it becomes common knowledge, it'll probably be used a lot. Nodding my head, I moved on to the next order of business, which was, do I really have anything that needs my immediate attention? I glanced through the world again, and aside from a couple of mundane wars fought over territory or people catching up to the Metal Age, there actually didn't seem to be much new going on. It was at that moment that I remembered the existence of the Herox, and went in to check on them. They're still living in caves? At least they seem to have fire, but there honestly wasn't much more to their civilization yet beyond that. I wonder how far behind in terms of civilization the absence of a god will leave them. Then again, they also had a much later start to begin with. I gave it some thought, and decided to check in on them again after my next major fast-forward. Ah, I hadn't checked on the underworld in a while. Within the underworld, a significant change had spread throughout the last several hundred years. This all started when the governor of the Fallen stepped down, choosing to hand his position over to a high-ranking Deva official. Before that, many people had still stubbornly refused to follow the rules left behind by the goddess, saying that there was no reason to follow a creature that was more beast than man. Even with the various restrictions placed on those that did not follow the system, their stubborn pride had made them unrelenting. There were examples of this in almost all races, aside from the centaurs themselves. However, seeing this, the previous governor could only resign himself to handing the position over to a native of the realm. Now, Jainum Tatar led the underworld, and things were different than they had been, although some people still stubbornly resisted the system, demanding that their own races be in charge. They were by far the minority. At the same time, several new systems had been put in place under the new governor's orders. The previous Spirit Academy was now divided in two. On one side, there was the School of Thought, an academy designed to educate various students about the history of both the living world and the underworld, as well as training those who would become the Reapers. The other side was the School of War, which contained the previous Pagoda of Trials, as well as taking the liberty to train future spirit hunters. In order to be recognized as a full citizen of the underworld, it was necessary to pass the first tests of both the school of thought and the school of war, showing that someone had the basic aptitude to survive in the underworld. In order to qualify for the army of souls, one must pass the third test of at least one school. Most people chose not to join the army, as it was possible to live a long and simple life, even without doing so. Given the very nature of the world, currency posed very little value, so they would not be forced to work for a living. However, if they wanted anything extravagant, they would need to barter. And in order to have anything worth bartering, having either more power or a higher education was needed. Yet the highest level anyone had ever reached in the School of War was the 12th floor. Within the 12th floor, truly terrifying monsters resided. Some were almost big enough to swallow up an entire city, while others possessed slim and nimble bodies. At this time, someone was challenging that very floor. From his outer appearance, he seemed to be a human, but right now his eyes were pitch black. His body was covered with an ornate golden armor, while in his hands a pair of glistening swords were held. This man was once known as Nos Flem, a member of the Order Wraith, which watched over the safety of the human continent. With his former talent as a spirit tamer and spirit hunter, it was easy for him to move up in the ranks, gathering stronger and stronger powers. He had even returned to Earth in the regular patrols, all for the sake of his desire to grow. After dying over 100 years ago, Nos had long since hit the apex of power, but was never satisfied. In his mind, there was always something greater. This very building he was in served as proof of that.
"Bene, Chara, let's go,"
he spoke aloud, and his two swords hummed in approval. The true form of these blades were companions that Nos had known in life, as they too had been wraiths with him. Yet due to the constant warring of the humans, their lives had been cut short. Before their spirits could pass on, they met Nos and asked him to bind them to him. In their minds, their duties were not yet done, not so long as the spirits still threatened the land. Like this, Nos realized the greatest power of the spirit hunter, a power which could be achieved only when one received the soul of a powerful person. While his armor was formed from a simple lion, his two swords were able to release immense power. It did not take long for Nos to find his enemy for this floor. The one he encountered was of the giant type, which suited him fine. It was a towering behemoth, likely to be even larger than the pagoda itself if placed outside. And though it had a vaguely human shape, its skin squirmed with every movement. Aside from a giant mouth in place of where its stomach should have been, there were no real identifying features to it. Yet still, the moment Nos found it, the creature seemed to react as if it had seen him. Slowly, its hulking legs moved forward, bringing it closer and closer to Nos with every step. Seeing this, Nos chose to simply remain where he was, the grip on his swords tightening further. When the creature was just before him, it decided to go with the tried-and-true method of killing anything smaller than one's foot, by stepping on him. Nos watched as the giant squirming blob of a leg descended towards him, and two faint figures appeared behind him. These were the true forms of his swords, which could only appear when he used their powers. A flash of light struck through the skies, cleaving through the leg that had been descending. Nos's two swords were now respectively coated in light and shadow. While the blade of light severed all spirits in his path, the blade of darkness slashed out. Where it passed, the other leg of the giant monster seemed to be erased, causing it to fall back with a shout that echoed through the pagoda. Not missing his chance, Nos ran forward, slashing out with light and darkness together. Though this consumed a great deal of spiritual energy, this was a benefit of a spirit tamer, as their contracted spirits could pay the price for them. While he cut his way towards the belly of the beast, the hulking creature seemed to explode into scattered shards of flesh, which quickly reformed in the distance. This time he was much smaller than his previous appearance, but the mouth looked more vicious. When the mouth opened, a jet-black beam of energy shot out, and Nos thought for a moment that he heard the screams of fallen souls within the attack. This was an attack which most spiritual monsters could use, to a varying degree. Even so, it was rarely seen, as it required them to spend the souls of those they had devoured to launch it. 500? Maybe 6? Nas thought out loud, as he watched the beam coming towards him, estimating how many souls the creature had just consumed. He knew that he had no chance of blocking such a blast, even with his manifested armor. After slashing out once each with the swords of light and darkness, he ran to the side, avoiding the blast altogether, while circling closer to his opponent. When the creature saw that its attack had been delayed by the blasts of light and shadow, it hesitated to launch another. The toll of the first blast was already starting to show, its size beginning to decrease again. In the end, it decided to end the battle with its overwhelming strength, charging in to meet Nas head-on. Did it forget that I already cut off its legs once? Nas thought to himself, recalling just how dumb these spirits tended to be. Only the smaller ones showed any real intelligence, so he was happy to face a brute. When the two met again, the victor was already determined as Nas carved his way through the creature's core. This made him the first person in history to complete the 12th level. Yet he was not arrogant enough to immediately charge into the 13th. His swords had used up most of their energy, and would need to recharge for several days before he could fight like that again. "Okay, I guess that counts as interesting," I muttered to myself, watching the scene between the human and the spirit monster. Considering that the one he fought was just over level 200, that's a pretty good result. Even at max level, that left him over 50 levels below his enemy. Still, I doubted he'd be able to last long against the Chimera souls on the 13th floor. Looking around the rest of the underworld, I found that it had undergone another expansion. Cities were now closer together, and more abundant than they had been before. This was likely a result of various powerful spirits setting up their own territories within the underworld, and inhabitants naturally gathering around them. Not everyone had the willpower to create an entire home out of smoke, after all. Is there anything else? I thought, as I looked around the various areas of the world, before deciding I was done for now. I guess I can go let Terra and Aravi know that I'll be down soon. I could feel a small smile on my lips as I thought about visiting the two of them. Chapter 21 I was just getting ready to set up my body for descending to the mortal world again, when the door burst open and a tiny missile came flying in my direction. "Dale!" Aravi shouted out as she wrapped her arms around my neck. "Big Sis said you were finally ready to come down and visit us." I chuckled as I heard that, nodding my head. "That's right. I was just setting everything up right now to do that." Aravi smiled happily as she heard that, her eyes becoming upturned crescents. "Finally! But could you fast-forward by about 2 days first?" she asked. And I really didn't see a reason to refuse, although I was curious. "Is something happening in 2 days?" I felt my eyebrow quirking up as I asked that. "It's a surprise." She let out a small giggle as she said that, finally pulling her arms off of me. "The two of us are staying in the city of Heldar, in the kingdom Eudonia. Once you head down, we'll meet you in front of the southern gate." "Okay. Anything else I should know, or should I make a reputation for myself before I head down?" I questioned, seeing as how they seemed to have a fairly specific plan for how we were going to spend our time. Aravi tilted her head, seeming to consider the question seriously, before closing her eyes and shaking her head rapidly. "Nope, blank slate should be just fine," she assured me. Nodding my head, I turned back to the computer and fast-forwarded 2 days, as I had been requested. It was such a small leap that it barely even counted for anything, so I didn't mind at all. As for the city that she requested, I did a brief search and found that it was the capital of Eudonia. Guessing there is something fairly big happening today. Seeing as I knew where I was going, I went ahead and returned to working on the body I would use to descend. Since I was going to Eudonia, a kitsune should do just fine. For hair color, let's go with a dark red. Otherwise, I kept most of my features in line with my normal body. Now a name. I'm not really going down there to do anything major this time, so just calling myself Mitchell would work just fine. I nodded my head before finalizing the decision. Body verified. Kitsune race selected. Beginning descent. May you work for the betterment of your world, Keeper. I felt the blue lights envelop me, causing me to close my eyes as I descended into the world. Naturally, I didn't forget to grab my storage bag, as I never go anywhere anymore without it. When I arrived, I was in a small forest, just off the dirt path leading to the city. I wanted to give myself a good bit of distance from anyone else that might spot my arrival, and thankfully this area was clear of any beastkin. Moving on to the dirt road, I set my destination for the nearby city. From this distance, I could see a rough outline of the architecture involved. The city's outer walls, like so many others, appeared to have been created by a group of druids. This caused it to appear as a single, smooth surface, rather than a pile of stone bricks. One thing I noticed that was different from Kaubunga's walls was the addition of parapets, small sections of raised stone, placed regularly along the top of the wall. This actually confused me for a moment, as that was typically used as a defense in times of war. While they didn't exactly go away during peace times, part of me questioned why they were even there in the first place. Perhaps it is for the guards to better shoot down attacking monsters. I briefly considered that idea, nodding my head. Unsurprisingly, the wall did not appear to have any kind of ward that I could make out from this distance. Rian said that wards were a relatively uncharted field of magic, so I wasn't really expecting to find them commonly on cities for at least a few hundred years. Contrary to the stone wall, there was a large wooden gate that stood wide open where the dirt path met the wall. Beyond the gate, I saw several small buildings. Unlike the elven city I had recently visited, the buildings of Heldar appeared to be constructed of wood instead of stone. I could see several window holes in the sides of buildings, but there was no glass being used in this region. No guard attempted to stop me as I entered the city, although there was one posted just outside the gate, and another atop the walls. The one on the ground, an Ursa man with strong features, even greeted me with a smile and a nod. Within the city, I could hear a multitude of voices talking merrily. From the information I saw about the city before descending, roughly 10,000 beastkin lived here. Judging by the size of the place, that seemed to be an accurate estimation. Although there were not very many homes with multiple floors, there were long roads with buildings on either side. I had even seen branching dirt paths on the way in, which seemed to lead to farmland outside of the city's walls. "Over here," a voice suddenly called out to me, and I turned my head, finding a pair of beautiful young women running towards me. The two seemed to be almost identical in their appearance, both just shy of 5.5 feet, looking to be in their later teens or early 20s. Their bodies were well proportioned, and they each had dog tails swaying behind them, as well as large furred ears atop their heads. The only difference was that one had silver hair and wore a black dress, while the other had black hair and wore a silver dress. "Name, please, if you would," I heard Aravi's excited voice calling into my mind, and readily answered that I would be going by Mitchell. As soon as I did, the silver-haired sister ran up and took my hand, dragging me towards the other one. "You finally made it, Mitchell. We've been waiting for you." Oh, so silver hair is Aravi, and black hair is Terra. As I thought that, I looked towards the black-haired sister, seeing an almost goofy smile that I hadn't seen on the feline goddess in so long. "Sorry to keep you waiting." "So, what's the big event?" I asked, nodding my head towards the direction of the city center, where I could hear more voices speaking loudly. Every now and then we would see someone walking out of their homes and heading in that direction, as if it were only natural. Terra's incarnation spoke up without a second thought. "It's the weekly festival of Daka, the day of rest and celebration," she said, as she grabbed my free hand. "Come on, Mirren and I can show you." Okay, so Aravi is Mirren. Now, would someone do a convenient name drop for Terra's incarnation? It would be so much appreciated. As I thought that, I nodded my head towards the two of them, causing Mirren to laugh. "Come on, Rin. Let's hurry up or we'll miss the fun." And Rivi comes in for the save. So what is Dakha to celebrate, anyways? I tried to use the language knowledge granted to me by the system, but the word did not seem to have any direct translations. Thankfully, Mirren answered my question pretty regularly. It's the day that the four goddesses created the four kingdoms. It is said that they communed with their priests for 6 days and nights to set up the land and structure of the kingdoms. On the seventh day, they went silent, allowing their people time to rest. Yet at the same time, it was a time of celebration because the four kingdoms were still united. I couldn't help but glance over to Rin as I heard that, recalling the version of history that Tara had told me before. She shook her head, smiling knowingly. The goddesses work in mysterious ways, sometimes without ever actually doing any work at all, yet people still perceive it as so. Or maybe they just wanted a convenient excuse? That is sadly true. Saying that it was the idea of the goddesses themselves to divide the kingdom gives a perfect reason to keep the church in the highest position of power. As we turned a corner, I saw a pair of feline children running past us, each with a ribbon on their arm. One of the ribbons was white, while the other was brown. It looked like they were being chased, so I turned my attention towards the larger group of kids running after them. They all had playful smiles, so it didn't seem to be bullying. And again, there were ribbons on the arms of each child, though the ribbons on those kids were all blue. And what is that? Mirren looked between the two groups of kids, covering her mouth to suppress a laugh. Oh, this'll be good. That is the goddess's keeper game that they play every Dakha. Explanation needed. Seeing the stiff look on my face, the two sisters looked at each other with satisfied smiles, before Rin took over. There is a legend of a being who stands above the goddesses, someone who is faceless and formless, yet can alter the very world itself with a thought. Some people call him the Father, some people call him the Maker, but the common term that has developed is that he is the one who protects us, keeps our world safe. So he has come to be known as the goddess's keeper. Giggling, Mirren took over from there, and we could see more children walking around with blue ribbons, as if searching for someone. When the festival of Dakha first began, a bunch of kids decided to make a game of the legend. Everyone involved is given a single ribbon to wrap around their arm. Blue ribbons indicate the mortals, who worship the goddesses. Most kids have a blue ribbon, but there are four special ones. The white ribbon marks Udona, brown marks Calliope, black marks Acalia, and red marks Tara. If anyone with a blue ribbon catches one of the goddesses, they exchange ribbons. Rin couldn't suppress the grin on her face as Mirren explained the rules of the game, and I knew there was more. However, among the blue ribbons there is one special one. On the inside of one of them there will be a golden band. That person becomes the goddess's keeper. In order to win the game, you have to have either one of the goddess's ribbons or the keeper ribbon by the time the game ends in the evening. My life has turned into a children's game of tag? There aren't any other similar games, are there? I couldn't help but ask, looking between the two as they burst out laughing. No, playing that keeps them pretty busy. Some kids play other games among themselves, but most either stick with this game or help out the adults, Rin explained with a shrug of her shoulders, still grinning happily. What about security? Monsters won't just stop attacking once a week because of the festival, will they? I mean, if anything, they should be attacking in greater numbers, because all of the juicy targets are in the city. Rin nodded her head, as if understanding the question. For safety, there are patrols going through the nearby area every day, including Dakha. While it means some people don't get to enjoy the festivities, they rotate them regularly so that nobody is completely left out. I see. So aside from this game, what else is there to do on Dakha? Surely the two of you didn't ask me to delay my arrival just for that. Though I could completely see Tara doing it just to mess with me, but I couldn't see Aravi doing that. Mirren grinned slightly, and we finally got to what seemed to be the largest building in the city. This is the theater. Every Dakha there are performances held here. We wanted to bring you here to watch those, she assured, winking playfully to me as she finally let go of my hand. Rin soon joined her, and the two ran straight towards the theater, right past a line of people who were waiting for admittance. Oh, great, they're performers. though seeing them running like that did answer a small question I had been wondering about regarding beastkin fashion. Apparently their dresses were cut just above where the base of their tails were, giving a brief glimpse of skin before pants covered everything below the tail. Still, very pretty. Chapter 22. The theater itself seemed to be the only multi-story building in the entire city, consisting of a total of 3 floors. Each floor formed an overhang that cast shade over the floor below it, yet at the same time created a nice architectural design. Once the line progressed and I was allowed in, I was guided up to the 3rd floor, where a vast majority of the seating was held. Looking at the rest of the audience, I couldn't make out any kind of racial discrimination, as everyone was here in seemingly equal numbers, though it seemed like there might be more kitsune, but that was entirely likely since this was Eudonia. Down below, I saw the stage, surrounded on almost all sides by the audience, with only its back free. On the stage, I saw 15 women, each holding a long, thin stick. At the end of each stick was a bundle of ribbon arranged like a flower, with various colors present among them. Among the women, I noticed Mirin and Rin standing near the back, with Mirin holding a black flower ribbon and Rin a white one. Finally, a male Lycan walked out, dressed in a regal white suit. As he spoke, his voice transmitted to each and every member of the audience, as if using an unseen microphone. "Thank you all for attending today. For this Dakar Festival, we have prepared a special treat, a very important part of our history, passed down through the generations since time immemorial. I give you all the Spring of 4 Divines. He gave a bow towards the audience before walking off stage, followed by all but 4 of the women, who bowed their bodies low, their ribbon batons held at a full arm's length. When the man's voice rang out again, the 4 women began moving, walking in a counterclockwise motion around the stage. I noticed that among the 4, there was 1 of each type of beastkin. In the beginning, the races were naught but scattered tribes, wandering the wilderness, gradually drifting further and further apart. As if to emphasize his words, the gap between the women became wider and wider. The goddesses, seeing our plight, sought to aid us. Not in the strength of self, but in unity. They sent their divine messages to members of different tribes to call a gathering, the first gathering in our known history. This time the women slightly changed their pace, slowly spiraling inwards towards the center of the stage where they met up. Each one hooked their left arm in the center, grabbing the hand of the woman opposite them. Some tribesmen fought them initially, but the 4 messengers showed them that the bonds formed between them were stronger than that of those disparate tribes. The 4 women began walking in a circle again, arms still locked together. Although they sought to spread the message of love, they were not above the use of force to defend that bond. Finally, with a flick of their wrists, the ribbons all unfurled. The colors of the ribbons were the same as with the keeper game outside: white, black, brown, and red. They raised the ribbons above their heads, letting them form a connected circle that surrounded the 4 of them. Through their combined efforts, the 1st city was formed, which would later be known as Terraria. The 4 women broke apart, spinning on their feet as they moved in a straight line from each other, their ribbons dancing in the air around them. The feline holding the red ribbon happened to be dancing towards the front of the stage. Yet they needed a leader, someone to guide their new nation. The 4 chose Ardra, Child of Terra. She ushered in the 1st generation of peace. The feline woman offered a low bow, a ribbon dancing behind her, though the bow was short-lived. When she stood up again, she cartwheeled off to the side of the stage, her ribbon forming an almost perfect circle around her body. Then, one by one, the other women came up and did the same. Many thought that Ardra would choose her own daughter to succeed her, as she seemed a worthy leader herself. But Ardra would not allow it. Instead, she remembered the love of her sisters and called forth a young kitsune, Mara Eversong. Her voice ushered in the 2nd generation. Following in this tradition, the 2nd queen appointed the Lycan child, Thalia Fairwind. and after her the huntswoman, Grella Stormflower. Like this, a cycle, which would last countless generations, began. Finally, there was nobody left on stage. Terraria grew, and every generation the torch would be passed to another race, a cycle which showed the bond between us, between the sister goddesses themselves. Yet soon, Terraria had grown too far. Following their cue, all 15 girls danced onto the stage, their ribbons flowing around them as they mingled and intertwined, yet never seemed to get in each other's way. Soon it was not enough to have but a single kingdom. I noticed only one of the women, Rin, seemed to not be dancing, standing in the center of all others, her body often obscured as she looked around in what seemed to be panic. A single queen's reach was unable to completely grasp the land on which we roam. So once again the sister goddesses showed their love for their people. 10 of the dancers dispersed, leaving only Mirin, Rin, and 2 other women. Aside from Rin, the other 3 walked around her, their expression seeming to calm as their ribbons danced along her waist. They spoke to their priests and delivered their divine message. "Divide the kingdom," they said. Yet the queen was afraid, not to give up her throne, but to destroy the unity her people shared. "Don't worry," they said. "We shall always watch over you." The 4 dancers representing the goddesses slowly began to move away, and Rin unfurled her own white ribbon, slowly beginning to dance and twirl about. They promised her a unity even greater than before, because even though the kingdoms held a different banner, they were all the children of the goddesses. As the 4 goddess dancers danced off stage, 3 more came in to dance with Rin. Thus they created Eudonia, following our goddess, Eudona, of the spring bloom. Terraria became the home of Terra, of the summer harvest. They created Kilios, home to Calliope of the autumn sun, and finally they created Akal, home to Acalia of the winter moon. The 4 dancers representing the 4 kingdoms gradually moved further apart. From off stage, 2 dancers went to join each kingdom, dancing and twirling about. Under the loving gaze of the 4 divines, the sister goddesses, we have continued to prosper in harmony, and as long as we believe in them, we shall continue to do so forevermore. Slowly the 4 dancers began moving towards the edges of the stage, their ribbons falling lower without the constant momentum. I had to admit the dance itself was beautiful. It may not seem like much compared to modern standards, but it had its own beauty nonetheless. Even if I knew that some of the history that they were talking about was not entirely accurate, it made for a good story. And in time, nobody would really know the truth about it aside from me and those in the admin room. But was it so bad to have that truth painted over the original? In a way, wasn't it a better one? One which made the people happy? I saw several people standing, so naturally I joined them. However, rather than applause, they did something unexpected. The lichens howled, leaning their heads back with their fists on their chest. The feline roared, their arms creating an X in front of them. The Ursa stamped their feet and slapped their chest once, and finally the Kitsune clasped their hands in front of themselves and tilted their heads back, letting out a higher-pitched tone than the howl of the lichens, though in shorter bursts. The combinations of different sounds, as if almost natural, created a harmony that echoed through the theater. And while it did somewhat hurt my ears to be in the middle of it, I did appreciate how so many people were able to form a chorus like that so naturally. When the sounds finished, the performers came back to the stage and bowed to the audience in turn bowing to them. Following the shared bow, people began casually talking to their neighbors as they moved slowly towards the exits. I saw a couple of strangers seeking to start a conversation with me, but politely excused myself. At least I hope I was polite about it. It's hard to understand the customs that quickly. No sooner had I gotten outside than I found myself being pulled to the side by Mirin and Rin, who were laughing happily. "So, what did you think, Mitchell?" Mirin asked, with an excited expression. I couldn't help but smile at the 2 of them. "You both did great. Do you 2 dance like that often?" She nodded her head, and Rin excused herself to go fetch us a snack. "Yes, our parents said, when we were younger, that we should give it a try. After doing it a couple times, we decided we really liked it. We keep trying to rope the other three in, too, but they've been busy with their own projects. Mirren puffed her cheeks out cutely as she said that, and I could easily make out the little halfling goddess living in that body. So no advancing civilization, exploring new horizons, just exploring the life of a dancer? I teased, lightly, earning myself another giggle from her. Yeah, that's right. I really wanted to see what it's like to live in a big city like this, and Wren wanted to get away from the fighting for a while. She nodded her head quickly, moving off to the side of the dirt road to let other people pass. Soon Wren came back holding a large wooden tray, atop which were three pots of soup. "Soup's on," she said with a laugh, and we each took one of the bowls. In each was a carved wooden spoon, the soup itself being mostly broth, with a bit of meat and vegetables. "So, Mitchell, are you going to stick around for the rest of the festival?" she asked, as she looked over towards me. "There's more?" I asked in mild surprise. After the dance and the game they showed me earlier, I didn't know what more to expect from a weekly festival like this. "Of course there is," she laughed, while Mirren began to happily enjoy her soup, letting out delighted noises with every spoonful. "Later on they'll be drinking. And every week there are taverns that try out new dishes to get people's opinions for new recipes. Today's soup is actually a new experiment from one of them." "It's really good," Mirren assured us, her mouth still mostly full. Curious, I took a spoonful of the soup. At first it seemed somewhat spicy, but then that taste seemed to be washed away when I bit into some of the meat. Juicy and savory, it almost literally melted in my mouth. I had to admit that this was tastier than a lot of meals I had back before the whole keeper business. "It actually is pretty good," I said, with just a bit of surprise. I honestly hadn't expected a meal cooked in this time period to really taste good to someone with a more modern palate. "I suppose I could stay for a few hours," I answered with mock reluctance. I was actually quite curious to see what else this place had to offer. If it weren't so dirty, I might actually consider living here myself for a few years. However, it wasn't really at the level I'd find livable yet. "Awesome," Mirren nodded as she heard that. "But what do you do for currency?" I couldn't help but ask that. It hasn't been long enough since metalworking became a thing for the Beastkin that they would have a currency such as silver and gold. "Barter, mostly," Wren answered, shrugging her shoulders. "For small trades like these bowls of soup, it's generally fine as long as we return the bowls. Sometimes people offer livestock, food, or even precious gems in trade." "What, like diamonds and rubies?" I asked, surprised that such items are casually tossed around in barters. "Sometimes," she confirmed, nodding her head, before taking a spoonful of her own soup and letting out a happy groan. Definitely telling him to keep this recipe. "But yeah, unless the gem is more than a few centimeters or is exceptionally pure, it won't go for much in a trade. You might be able to get a single bajin, a weird type of three-horned cow, or a quality weapon for it, though quality by current standards. Yeah, I doubt there'll be anything to replace my sword for a long time." I nodded my head, sipping my way through my soup until there was none left, before putting my bowl back on the tray. "All right, what's next?" Chapter 23. After sampling the Beastkin food, we moved on to the next bit of entertainment that the Dakka had to offer. "Oh, I'm surprised that they are doing this week," Wren said, in an excited tone as she pulled us along towards a crowd of people that were letting out cheers and shouts. Seeing as we could barely hear each other over the volume and couldn't talk about some things openly, Tara sent me a message using her god voice. "This is the Dakka Shah, a fight that happens whenever someone wants to challenge the Sharae, a reigning champion." As I listened to her explanation, we finally pushed our way through to the front row of the crowd. In front of us there was a kitsune and an ursa, both male. The ursa had leather straps wrapped around his wrists, while the kitsune was wielding a long wooden staff. "He is Fenric, the current Sharae. He's managed to hold the title for nearly a year now," I heard her telling me as I looked towards the kitsune. Just then the larger ursa charged forward, using his superior size and strength to try to overwhelm Fenric. Oddly, I noticed his footwork seemed very practiced, and he kept himself controlled far better than I would expect a fighter in this age. No doubt he was a martial artist practicing the techniques that Calliope brought down with her. At the last second before reaching Fenric, he planted one foot into the ground and struck out with an open palm. The strength behind the strike was enough that I could begin to see the air distort slightly around it.